operation of law after 75 days, if not by written order prior to that time. My first argument is that construed together in harmony, compliance with Rule 324 and 329B satisfies the requirements of Rule 52. Rule 52, of course, has three basic requirements: a timely request, objection, or motion that states the specific grounds for the desired ruling, and the party must obtain a ruling. Mrs. Cecil complied with these requirements in complying with 324 and 329B. She filed her motion within 30 days as set forth in 329B. She stated her points as required in Rule 324 of factual insufficiency, and she requested the relief of a new trial, and she obtained a ruling by virtue of the fact that under 329B, the motion is overruled by operation of law when not ruled upon expressly by the trial judge. My second point is that the title court has used the general rule, Rule 52, to override the specific rule, Rule 329. And in so doing, it violated the federal rule of construction that a specific rule of procedure controls of a general rule of procedure in the event of any conflict. If you can't harmonize the rules, and then if there is some conflict, then 329B should control. Also, the court violated, I think, the general rule that the court should construe the rules liberally in favor of a decision on the merits instead of hyper-technically as a means of disposing of cases on a procedural point such as waiver. Last week in DSC Finance Corp versus Moffitt, this court held that the preservation considerations of Rule 52 do not apply to a petition for writ of error, because such an appeal carries with it specific guidelines for review. Likewise, Rule 329B and Rule 324 carries with them specific guidelines for review. They set forth a specific procedure on how a party asserts complaints in a motion for new trial, how a ruling is obtained on that motion, and how an appeal is taken from that point forward. If you apply the title court's analysis of Rule 52 across the board, Rule 52 then in effect obliterates a number of other rules in different contexts that have been long-standing rules. And I can think of two examples. One is that Texas Rule of Civil Evidence 605 says that a judge may not testify as a witness and that no objection need to be made to preserve the complaint. Yet the title court's analysis would say Rule 52 overrides that, and that if a party did not complain for the judge's testimony as a witness, then that complaint is waived. Another idea is fundamental error. It's a very limited doctrine, but ordinarily fundamental error, such as the court lacks subject matter jurisdiction, need not be raised in the trial court. It can be raised for the first time on appeal. 52 should not override that principle of fundamental error. My third point is that the title court ignored the plain meaning of Rule 329B and effectively added a presentment requirement. In Turin Industries, this court considered Rule 296, which provides for the filing of a request for findings of fact and conclusions of law. There have been a long line of cases prior to Turin that said not only does the party have to comply with the rule, file the request in the time prescribed by the rule, the party must also actually present the request to the trial judge and have the trial judge sign off on it. Turin Industries said that the plain literal language of 296, Rule 296, only required filing within the prescribed timeline, and anything beyond that is contrary to what the plain meaning of the rule is. And this court rejected this unwieldy process of being able to prove that the trial judge was actually subjectively aware of a request. As I mentioned, prior to January 1, 1981, Rule 329B had an express requirement for presentment, and that the motion for new trial had to be presented within 30 days. But even under that rule, when it had the express requirement of presentment, in Moore versus Malden, this court held that the failure to present did not waive the complaints for appeal. It just meant that the party ran the risk of having the motion for new trial overruled by operation of law. The fourth point concerns this presumption that the title court has created, and this is a big problem, because how do you overcome this presumption that the trial judge is unaware of a filed and docketed motion for new trial. In effect, I think it's going to require parties to hold hearings on every motion, because otherwise you cannot make the record reflect that. What do you do when the trial judge refuses to rule or refuses to hold a hearing? I wonder whether in some sort of ex parte communication like a letter confirming the fact that the judge won't rule would be sufficient. Rule 329B has a time-tested method for handling this, and that is it's overruled by operation of law, and that's sufficient to preserve error. In my remaining time, I'd like to briefly speak to point of error 2, which the court has not granted writ on, but I think it's a significant point, and I would direct the court's attention to that. That involved a question concerning ownership of the certificate of deposit, and it involves the application of probate code section 438. Basically what happened is there was a CD, it was a joint account made payable to A or B, made payable to the mother or Mrs. Cecil, the petitioner. And during the lifetime of those parties, the CD matured, Mrs. Cecil went down, took the funds from the CD and put them in her own account. Then later, a year later, her mother died, and the respondent, Matt Smith, raised the argument that the estate actually owned the CD. It was Mrs. Cecil's position that under Probate Code Section 438, the sole consideration on ownership is who owned the funds used to start the account. That's what Probate Code Section 438 provides. She requested a question to be submitted to the jury that was limited to that issue. The judge denied her requested question and instead submitted a general question as to who was the owner of this account. And in this general question, it allowed the jury to consider other facts that Matt Smith argued established ownership, such as the fact that the mother's name was first on the CD, that the earning statements for interest from the CD were sent to the mother's address, and that they also had the mother's Social Security number on them. Those facts are completely irrelevant under the probate code as to who owned the joint account as between those parties. And for that reason, in connection with point of error 2, we're asking the court to reverse and remand to the trial court because the title court has already rejected this complaint in the appeal. As to point of error 1, we're requesting the court to reverse the title court's decision that error was not preserved by the filing of a motion for new trial. It was overruled by operation of law, and remand to that court for consideration of those points on the merits.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. James Attaway will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. My argument to the court will consist of a reply to what I believe are four subpoints of petitioner's point of error number one, and they will correlate, I think, somewhat along the line that he presented his argument to the court. First of all, Your Honors, the petitioner argues to this court that by complying with two rules of civil procedure, she preserved points of error and should have been allowed to present those points of error to the Court of Appeals in Tyler. First of all, she says that by filing her timely motion for new trial, that she met the requirements of Rule 324. And then she says that when the motion for new trial was overruled by operation of law under the provisions of Rule 329B, that she met that requirement, and therefore she preserved her points of error for appellate review. The holding of the Court of Appeals in Tyler was that the petitioner did not preserve her points of error for review under the provisions of or in compliance with 52A, Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure. Now, the petitioner's attitude toward this appellate rule seems to be twofold. First of all, in her argument and her brief, she seems to ignore it and say, well, if I comply with the other two civil rules, well, then I will be able to present my points of error on appeal. Secondly, she says that she complied with both of these trial rules and that she therefore satisfied the appellate rule 52A. But I would point out to the court that Rule 324 and Rule 329B have a set of requirements. Rule 52A also has a set of requirements, and it's my position, I believe the position of the Court of Appeals in Tyler, that in order to present her points of error in the motion for new trial on appeal, she must comply with all of those requirements in both sets of the rules.
Counsel, is it true that at the time you presented oral argument before the Tyler Court of Appeals, neither you did not argue this point, it was not argued by you, or was it mentioned in the brief? Is it something that the Court of Appeals came up on its own after both of you left the court?
I did not address that in my argument, Your Honor.
Was you equally surprised as the counsel was that the Court of Appeals ceased on this point to reverse?
Well, after I read the cases and read and looked at the reason in the court, I was not surprised. I thought I should have discovered that and put it in my brief. That was my attitude, Judge.
Is there any problem? Now, they use this to affirm the case, not to reverse it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there, but don't you have a problem with a possible waiver by not having this as a cross point? Or?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I'm not prepared to argue that. I can present that, answer that in the supplemental brief if it pleases the court.
Is anybody else interested? I'll tell you if I'm interested by the end of the. If I'm interested, I'll tell you by the end of the argument.
Right. How do you think Draft 52 should have been complied with in a case like this? If the judge doesn't pay any attention to what motions were filed, going to open his mail or respond to phone calls, or what do you do?
Your Honor, I've been thinking about that. I think it would be solved by two simple documents. Well, not that simple, but have two one-page pleas. First of all, the first pleading could be entitled Request for Hearing and Ruling on a Motion for a New Trial. File that and place on there.
What if nothing's done?
Well, then you file the second one, which would be entitled Objection. The trial court's refusal to rule on motion for new trial. But that's in the record, and that would show, at least it would show what the Court of Appeals in Tyler talked about and seemed to be concerned about, that it was brought to the attention of the trial court.
So, but under that theory, petitioner's right, the trial judge ought to have to actually rule on every motion for new trial that's filed, and not just let them.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear your question.
So the petitioner is right that under that theory, the trial judge would have to rule on every motion for new trial and
no,
not
you,
just let them be overruled.
No, Your Honor, and as a matter of fact, the Tyler Court of Appeals looked back to two decisions of this court, one in 1968 and then and one in 1962. And in fact, they addressed that in their order on the motion for rehearing, and they specifically said that we did not hold that a party had to present a motion in the context of securing a hearing on the motion, but indicated only that the court's attention should be directed to the motion for a new trial. And
right,
that would apparently
that?
Meet the presentment requisites of 52A.
Under the old, now discarded practice, at least on an initial motion for new trial after a default judgment, after a non-jury trial, we required some kind of signature by the judge on some document that he had considered a request for findings of fact, conclusions of law. Has this ever been spelled out, what you have to do? I mean, surely it's not just an ex parte communication with the judge.
All right. I'm not sure exactly what your
question
is.
What do you think, I guess the same question's been asked. What does presentment under Rule 52A seems to me to be thinking mainly about being in the middle of a trial and presenting an objection to a judge or tendering some document when you're in this situation post-trial or I suppose in a pre-trial situation. When you're not in open court, what is necessary? What do you have to have in the record to show that a judge considered?
Well, Your Honor, that the trial court's attention was directed to either the motion for new trial or objection or request, and some evidence to show that in the pleadings that we were talking about, the two one-page pleadings a while ago would show that if, in fact, he refused to set a hearing on the motion for new trial, then you could document that in some way by filing a pleading in the court. first of all, on the request for the hearing and the request to rule on the motion for new trial. And if you did not do so, then and file a document entitled Objection to the Trial Court's Refusal to Rule on it.
Why do we require parties to file a motion for a new trial?
So
that the trial judge actually will be required to review his or her errors in the case, or is it just to give the trial judge an opportunity?
I think it's judicial economy, Your Honor, and I believe that this, in the concurring opinion of the Meantop case, which apparently the Court of Appeals adopted, at least approved of in this case, spells that out pretty clearly. It's so that the trial court can have a chance at that level to correct these errors, and so that you can avoid the expensive time-consuming and otherwise onerous long appellate process.
Is it the insufficiency of evidence points that were not addressed by the Court of Appeals because of its construction of the motion for new trial rule?
Yes, Your Honor, that was.
That's 6 points.
Yes, it was. I've answered most of these questions, but if I may, the second point that the petitioner makes is that the Court of Appeals improperly added the presentment requirement to Rules 324 and Rules 329B, which this court eliminated in 1981 when the rules were amended. But the presentment requirement that the petitioner complains about in this case is found in the plain language of Rule 52A. As the court is aware, it reads this way: to preserve a complaint for appellate review, a party must have presented to the trial court a timely motion in this case. So the Court of Appeals did not add that presentment language, but only read the plain language of Rule 52A.
Isn't that a bit of a trap for them, Larry, for us to have a spell out the specific requirements on motions for new trial, our rules of civil procedure, and then have a general rule stuck over in the appellate procedure rules that modified it?
Your Honor, I would respond to that as, you know, the Court of Appeals ruled specifically based on the language, the plain language of 52A, and it seems to me that Rule 324, Rule 329B, the Rules of Civil Procedure do not conflict, but they work together, and that both set of requirements and both rules are required. Now, the petitioner has also argued to the court in the brief that the decision by the Tyler Court creates an impractical obstacle to the administration of justice. My position is that's based on a false premise, the false premise being that the Tyler Court of Appeals decision would require one to personally present a motion for a new trial to the trial judge, and therefore create unnecessary work for the trial judges, for the parties, to increase the expenses of litigation and cause delays. We need to remember that the Tyler Court of Appeals decision requires only directing the court's attention to the motion and does not require a personal presentation or a hearing on it. Now, the rules of construction is one of the points that the counsel for petitioner has mentioned to the court. I would urge the court that this does not apply. There is no conflict because the special rule that we're talking about, Rule 329B, is not an exception to or a qualification of the general rule in 52A. There are two different rules that require two different sets of requirements. So there is no conflict. And I would ask, Your Honors, that you overrule the point of error number one, and that you affirm the courts below. This started off, of course, with a unanimous jury verdict and a trial court in Henderson County, and to the Court of Appeals of Tyler, and now up to this honorable court. And I'd ask that your decision today be an affirmation of the courts below.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
I think the problem with Rule 52 is that it's increasingly being used by courts, and I think this case will send a direction one way or another as to the scope of Rule 52, whether it overrides all other provisions for perfecting error and can be used as a procedural means of disposing of cases or not. Of course, when you're talking about a motion for new trial, the question was asked, for whose benefit is this? Is it for the trial judge? Is it for some other purpose? And in that connection, of course, the trial judge, one thing that's unique about the motion for new trial practice is the trial judge can grant a motion on his own. No motion for new trial need be filed. If the trial judge feels like the evidence is factually insufficient or legally insufficient, the court can grant a new trial in the interest of justice. I think for that reason, this, like the provisions for petition for writ of error, makes this a special class of appellate review and preservation of error to which Rule 52 should not apply. The basic problem with the title force presumption that's been discussed is that although the court denies that it's requiring a hearing on every motion, that's going to be the net effect. Every time a motion for new trial is filed, it's going to be necessary for the party to request a hearing on it and obtain a ruling from the court, or at least make a record of the fact that the judge will not rule on the motion. I'll conclude by quoting from Justice Ray in his concurring opinion in Donworth v. Preston II, Chrysler Dodge, when he said, "This court has labored long and hard to remove as many procedural traps from our rules as possible. Litigants are entitled to have their disputes resolved on the merits, not on unnecessary and arcane points that can sneak up on even the most diligent of attorneys." We're requesting that the court reverse the trial court's decision concerning the effect of Rule 52 and remand to that case for a decision on the merits of the insufficiency points.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the arguments in the second cause.
But I have one more announcement.
I will not be present for the third cause because of other obligations that you all may be able to guess at. I don't know if Judge Mullins is going to be back or not, but to my knowledge, all nine justices will participate in the deliberation and decision in Phillips v. Phillips.
The audience will please rise.